This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Dashran Johan. And what I'm going to be doing today is look back at some of the integral moments in Malaysian politics, particularly in the latter part of 2020, and listen to excerpts and anecdotes by various political analysts from the shows that we did throughout the year and try to make sense of the dramatic, unprecedented and tumultuous year of Malaysian politics as the nation suffers from a health and economic crisis. So first up, let's revisit an episode from July I did with Dr. Bridget Welsh, a political analyst and honorary research associate at the University of Nottingham Asia Research Institute. So this was a few months after Lanka Sheraton, in which, as we all know by now, PKR MP Azmin Ali and friends decided to defect from Pakatan Harapan, which caused the fall of the Mahathir-led administration and the formation of Perikatan Nasional led by Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin. Many Malaysians were starting to wonder if this marked the end of reformasi. After all, the results of G14 promised a new Malaysia, and the political landscape post Lanka Sheraton appeared to be a case of same old for many Malaysians. So is reformasi dead? Let's hear what Bridget Welsh had to say.
Well, let me take a step back before I take a step to the present. I think the reformasi movement from the 90s through 2018 was not just a political movement. It was also a social movement. And I think the best example of that social movement was the Bursay movement, which really gained traction from 2007 all the way through arguably 2018. And this movement really began, it was driven by middle-class society, middle-class people. It had multi-ethnic composition, and it was a movement focused on electoral reform, but it included a whole range of sets of issues. And I think what we saw in Bursay was the adoption of new repertoires, new ways of protesting, of getting issues across, new ways of forming alliances with different groups in civil society. And so these same things are happening, I would argue, now. Keep in mind that these movements sometimes emerge in difficult circumstances as opposed to necessarily in environments where things are flourishing. So what do we see? We see a larger, much more expanded civil society, a new generation of leaders that are coming in, and they're engaging in a whole range of issues. Now, you do have parts of civil society that are uncivil, but you do have lots of parts of civil society that are actually, engaging on questions of social justice, issues associated with, healthcare. You have issues associated with education.
Right.
And they're happening not just in the Klang Valley, but you can find this in KK. You could find this in Kuala Terengganu. And the philanthropy, for example, that we saw around the MCO in terms of helping in non-governmental organizations, helping people to get through this particular very difficult time, really shows this expanded civil society. You also see the composition of that has shifted. You have a broader underlying forces of a middle class. Yes, there are real sharp inequalities in Malaysia, but there still is a very large middle class that is participating and engaged in political life. And that hasn't shifted. Now is that there is a changing relationship with the political elite. Reformasi was traditionally always seen as something to be led by the leaders. Now I would say that is really something that has shifted. In fact, there were people who were moving away from a kind of elite-driven politics, would arguably for the last 5 or 6 years. This is where the nature of how civil society had transformed and diversified. But I think in particular in the last 5 months, there has been a different perceptions that political parties are not engaging in adequate reforms of their own, and that old leaders are holding back the transformation that many even within those parties would like. And in fact, society and the whole view of politicians has become more suspect. And I think this is true across the political divide.
And I'll just like to press that a little further.
Is it then fair to say that although Anwar Ibrahim, many see him as the guy that sort of pushed forward reformasi in Malaysia, but in actual fact, reformasi or the reformation movement in Malaysia isn't tied to any political party, but it's more about the people, what the people want, and a people's movement?
Well, first of all, I would say that political leaders will try to use the reform agenda for their advantage. These are realities, right? They're going to use the ways to mobilize the electorate they can think to their advantage. I think that, in fairness, Anwar Ibrahim's party still is associated with reformasi. And among some of his supporters, it is very strongly connected into that. But not everybody. And I think that, and I think the real question becomes is how many people associate him with that. And I think what's interesting to appreciate is that younger Malaysians don't have a very strong identity with him, because this was something of the 90s. And I think what is PKR's role in Pakatan Harapan's government was not one that was seen as leading reforms. In this context, so they don't have any specific reforms that party can speak to directly in a meaningful way. And of course, that party split as well, which of course helps to muddy the waters in this context. So I do think that, reformasi has evolved to be bigger than the individuals, but it still is being used politically for political purposes of parties. But those, how many people associate reforms with those parties is actually not so clear. Mm. And in fact, not as strong as they think it is, in part because the political parties across the political divide don't necessarily practice what they preach.
And then in September, the Merdeka Center released a poll which indicated that 69% of Malaysians approve of Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin's run as the Prime Minister, and that the Perikatan National Government is also well received compared to other parties or coalitions in the country. So this was a particularly interesting finding, as Perikatan National wasn't a government that was elected by the people. So how exactly did they garner popularity? Well, here's what Dr. Francis Hutchinson, who's a political analyst and the coordinator of the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute, had to say.
In addition to the things that we just talked about, I think, there are perceptions and issues that are important in the Malay heartland. So if you basically look at Malaysia's 222 electoral seats, parliamentary constituencies, you can divide them into four buckets. Mm. So the first one would be mixed seats, largely in urban areas on the peninsula. And there are about 48 seats. And these are areas where, Pakatan Harapan is very strong and actually was already strong in 2013. Then you have Malay majority seats, largely in rural areas, particularly on the east coast of the peninsula, but also just a little bit in from the west coast on the peninsula as well. And these, you've got 95 of these seats, right? And then you have 22 seats in the north that is more traditionally seen as past territory. And then you have about 57 seats in East Malaysia. So what happened in 2018 is that Pakatan Harapan was able to build on the seats that they had in the urban areas of the country to really make incursions into these rural Malay majority constituencies. But these constituencies, while they voted for Pakatan Harapan, they were not really so interested in reform issues. They were interested in cost of living issues, and they were interested in breaking the Najib Razak administration, really moving away from that. But it doesn't mean that they are insensitive to issues of the Malay community and so on, really. And so what Muhyiddin kind of offers this very important part of the country is continuity. He offers them a feeling of perhaps security, but also delivering on cost of living issues because of these stimulus measures, and also closure or the beginning of closure on the Najib Razak issue. So that is why I think we see quite a high level of popularity for him.
Okay, I do have another question about the current Prime Minister, but before we get into that specifically, I think we need to sort of set the tone about some of the other parties that are playing the political game right now. Why is Perikatan Nasional better received than Muafakat Nasional and Barisan Nasional, despite Perikatan Nasional as a whole mostly consisting of members of Muafakat Nasional, which is PAS and Barisan Nasional?
So I think that there are several dynamics at play. So the first one is that I think a majority of Malaysians, including Malay voters, like a multi-ethnic coalition in government. So now, as we just discussed, we know that in the second year of the Pakatan Harapan administration, there were rumblings that Malay voters and interests were not adequately taken into account or protected. Mm. So when you look at the structure and the leadership of Perikatan Nasional, it is, in essence, a Malay-led political grouping. You can't say it is dominated by a non-Malay party or by non-Malay figures. So this issue is addressed. But what distinguishes it from Barisan Nasional is that Barisan Nasional specifically is directly associated with UMNO, that for many people in the country has a number of senior leaders facing corruption charges. And this brings back memories of Najib Razak and the 1MDB issue, as well as, people like, UMNO party president Zahid, Kunan, and a range of other people, Pong Mokhtar in UMNO are also facing corruption charges. And then with regards to Muafakat Nasional, of course, this is very closely associated with PAS. PAS is an important member of this coalition. And while this does have support in many parts of the country, it is also viewed with extreme suspicion mixed urban areas, as well as much of East Malaysia, and even in some states like Johor, where electorally it doesn't do very well. So consequently, I think Perikatan Nasional comes across to voters now as a coalition that is more inclusive than Muafakat Nasional, but it doesn't have the baggage of Barisan Nasional, but it does have a secure Malay leadership.
You just heard a clip from a show I did earlier this year on Perikatan Nasional's popularity with Dr. Francis Hutchinson, who's the coordinator of the Malaysia Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. All right, we do need to go for a very quick break now, but when we come back, we will continue listening to some snippets from some of the best Live and Learn episodes of the year, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Dashran Johan, and I'm not joined by a guest today, and that's because we are doing a Best of Live and Learn 2020 with a focus on Malaysian politics. So what we are doing is listening to some snippets from a variety of political analysts that I had on the show with me this year. Now, before the break, we listened to a clip on Reformasi. Is it dead? Is it still a thing? And also a clip on why was the Perikatan Nasional government rather popular during the early stages of its tenure, despite being, as many put it, a backdoor government. Now let's think back to the formation of Parti Muda. So in September, in a move that nobody saw coming but many, particularly young people, found very inspiring, was that former Minister of Youth and Sport, Syed Saddiq, decided to start a new youth-led political party. Taking a page out of parties like Future Forward in Thailand and Marche in France, Syed Saddiq said that Muda aims to be a disruptive force that challenges the way politics is done in Malaysia. So it's a great idea, right? But the question on many people's mind, especially at the time, but even now, is can a youth party actually make a difference in Malaysia? And I also wanted to understand the youth demographic in the country a little bit more, especially in terms of their political leanings. So I caught up with political analyst Dr. Bridget Welch. This time, she was joined by James Chai, who's a political commentator himself and also the head of commercial and research at Invoke Solutions. And here's what they had to say.
In the past, how we study polling results has always been, like what you rightly said, which is based on race, and maybe economic background. We haven't filtered through that much based on age, although that is perfectly possible because of the polling stations that they vote from. In other words, we haven't had a consistent frame of thinking. Dr. Bridget might may correct me on how young people think of each generation. What I do know, at least, just based on the past analysis I've done on 2018's election, we started to see at least early signs about how maybe young people are more open to vote for candidates across racial lines. Because in the past, even the opinions of Malaysian voters on their favorite ministers have always been based on race. In other words, let's say an Indian voter would vote, would always say that their favorite ministers are, let's say, Mr. Gobind Singh, Mr. Xavier Jayakumar. So it's very much organized along those lines. Whereas young people, at least they are able to break out of that a little bit. I don't know whether this is consistent across the board, but there are early signs that young people think of it that way. But what I'm also thinking is that youth identity that YB Syed Saddiq is trying to appeal to refers to a way of thinking, particularly here. In other words, I don't know if, let's say, if things were okay and he built a youth movement, whether it would garner as much traction or not. The reason why it is very compelling an idea now is because youth refers to a way of thinking of trying to discard the old way of doing politics. Sometimes I think that just by introducing, let's say, another compelling cause that is not youth-based, people will be equally as excited because of the presence of an alternative that seems to appeal to our higher idealism. And therefore, if he's able to therefore draw that line to say that youth identity really refers to a way of thinking, that a future that is not tied to the past as well as not tied to, let's say, the egos of certain personalities is possible, then that is a compelling case, not only to young people, let's say below 35, but also cutting across different age groups, even right up to people in their 50s or 60s, as seen through a lot of the social media comments. But once again, this is not necessarily the most representative sample as well.
Well, I've looked very extensively at survey data, and I have a new report coming out next month that looks at survey data over the last 15 years. And so one of the things we look at are generational differences. And there have been a number of other studies on youth that have been done over time. So the what studies show us that the youth have many identities. But there is a uniqueness about the cohort. And in political science, we talk about people who've been shaped by a period of time, all right? So the Reformasi cohort is a particular period of time in Malaysian history. The NEP and the racial violence of 1969 is another cohort, right? So this cohort of people after 2018 are very interesting. The younger people get their news differently. They think about nationhood differently. They don't have quite the same hang-ups about race, although that is changing a bit about identity politics, but it's because they've grown up at a time, interestingly enough, of Malay dominance. So they don't necessarily have the same period. They have higher expectations and demands for the political process. They expect choices. There's a certain degree of impatience. So we can see that younger people are consistently voting for opposition in a much higher way in the past. They are ideologically more polarized. So what we have is that there are some who are they reflect the period of what we saw during Pakatan Harapan in particular. There are more liberals who are much more liberal, and then there's a large cohort that are much more conservative. Mm-hmm. And so there is this ideological polarization. As James was saying earlier, there's less engagement. So what's very important to understand is that these voters from under 30 to 21 have really underregistered. Let me give you an example of this. 41% of the young population in Selangor between 21 and 30 have not registered. 41%.
Wow.
Okay. In Sabah, it's 22%. So what we're talking about is that, there will be this missing generation that auto registration will be for people who come in, right? It won't be for these other people unless they register to vote. So in a sense, I think that what the youth movement slash party, whatever, how it emerges, is they have to find a way to carve out certain aspects of this. And this is where traditionally, when people talk about jobs, young issues of economic participation, economic livelihoods, that's where the way the politicians do that. Now it's about changing and dealing with some of the fact of how the youth are a unique cohort, but at the same time, on most issues, they're just like older Malaysians. So, and this is where it is really difficult. And where what James was pointing to is something very important, is that the youth narrative will be one that will be created.
You know, as I was preparing for this show, I realized that September was a month packed with political maneuvering and reshaping. The Sabah state elections also took place in September, the 26th to be exact, and what an absolutely heart-pounding affair it turned out to be. The elections came amid more attempts at politicking and party hopping. You know, ADUNs that were part of the Warisan government had decided to join Anwar Musa and UMNO and Perikatan Nasional. And recognizing what was going on, former Sabah chief minister called for the dissolution of the Sabah State Assembly, and following that, a snap elections, which was agreed by the governor of Sabah. So this caught everybody by surprise. However, Perikatan Nasional ended up winning these elections. Despite a razor-thin majority, they still won. But what did this result actually mean for our national political landscape? So once again, sat down with Dr. Bridget Welsh.
So let me just give you a reminder, is that people should stop taking what politicians say at face value. This is true across the political divide. You know, and we should recognize that comments by politicians are exactly that, comments by politicians that represent party positions and even propaganda in some cases. And I think that in the case of UMNO, UMNO was very calculating in giving statements that may not in fact actually be what they're feeling, but be about a distraction or be about a political move such as appeasement to the base. It is clear from my understanding is that the deal on Hajiji had been struck before Zahid Hamidi made his remarks. I think these remarks, I interpret them as an appeasement of the base and part of a show, but not necessarily any real substantive differences in that context. Yes, there are some, but whether or not it's at the elite level and whether or not the sort of accommodation had been made, those issues which were more serious in the early part of the campaign when Muhyiddin Yassin made those remarks were less as significant than I say the drama that played out over the media reporting of what happened afterwards. There were attempts to try to make defections on different sides. That's mm-hmm. the nature of politics. And I'd step back from this, and this is where a real challenge that Malaysia faces nationally is that how do you deal with a situation of coalition governments? Because in fact, what UMNO and GRS were doing and Warisan was trying was to form a coalition government. And these are normal processes. What makes this standard uniquely Malaysian is that everything is seen within a polarized framework. You betray this way. You do this to save the country this way, or you do it to save the party that way. And these emotions are real, and I don't want to discount those sensitivities and the substance of where they come from, because they do come from the experience that Malaysians have felt. But at the same time, we're also dealing with a different system of politics, where coalition forming is now a necessary process of building a government. And what GRS was trying to do was trying to build a stable coalition. And what Warisan was trying to do was to trying to prevent that from happening and to build their own.
Okay. And will the situation in Sabah encourage Zahid Hamidi's faction to join Anwar, if that is even a thing?
Well, look, in politics, things are fluid. Mm. And I think that the question is that people will use the issue of defections and in order to articulate as part of their political positioning. Is it true that possibly Zahid Hamidi was using this to push for issues of elections and to strengthen his position at the UMNO? Yes, possible. And indications are that there probably these things were going on. One has to give it a certain degree, in contrast to what I said earlier, a certain degree of some recognition of some of the realities when you see multiple sources of these factors. At the same time, what happens yesterday may not be what happens today or what happens tomorrow in a particular fluid political positioning. Is it clear that these issues of defections and threats to leave are real? Absolutely. And will they continue to be something that plays on the national stage? Absolutely. And it goes back to one of the points I raised earlier. UMNO is already playing this card, and it's playing this card because it believes that if it goes to elections, it will be hegemonic again. it will be able to come back and be in the dominant position. And that, and it does not like being secondary. And this is where Sabah is quite interesting, because it has taken a secondary role, which, of course, may be indicating that there are these challenges to this hegemonic position. But keep in mind, they have taken the secondary role to Bursatu, which, of course, is in many ways, for many people, UMNO.
You just heard a clip from a show I did earlier this year with Dr. Bridget Welch, analyzing the Sabah state elections and what it means for our national political scene. All right. We do need to go for another very quick break, but when we come back, we have one more snippet from some of the best Live and Learn episodes of the year, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Dafrin Johan, and today we are doing a best of Live and Learn 2020 with the focus on Malaysian politics. So we are listening to some clips from a variety of political analysts that I had on the show with me this year. Before the break, we listened to a snippet from a show I did with political analysts Dr. Bridget Welch and James Chai on the birth of Syed Saddiq's Parti Muda, as well as a clip from an episode on the Sabah state elections. Before we end today's recap show, I thought it'd be nice to revisit an episode I did only recently with political commenter James Chai on why Pakatan Harapan needs new leadership. This, of course, comes after Anwar Ibrahim's announcement that he has the numbers, which, let's be honest, actually resulted in nothing, as well as the failure of the opposition to vote down Budget 2021, something they said that they would do. Here's a snippet from our conversation.
I understand the struggles that Anwar had to go through. Now, his biggest contribution and his most lasting legacy has actually already materialized. It doesn't only materialize when he becomes prime minister. That's at least my view, which is the largest and probably the most effective political movements ever created in the history of Malaysia. Reformasi has produced many well-meaning reformists, not only within PKR, but across all of the political parties in the country. They were inspired by this sense that you have to right what has been wrong and institutions must be changed. And there's this growing sense of justice that hasn't really fully materialized in terms of a value-based system that people can hold on to in their pursuit of trying to assume political positions for the betterment of the country. I think that is his most lasting legacy. And therefore, there is some more die-hard, more traditional supporters of Anwar who cannot detach the struggle and Anwar altogether. Now, more sober reformists and well-meaning reformists would understand that the struggle has Anwar as part of it, but the struggle is not Anwar.
Do you think Anwar Ibrahim understands this?
Of course not, because like he definitely understands. I mean, every politician have a certain amount of pride in who they are. They would believe that their own judgments, after having gone through a lot, especially with bulk of experience, that they are able to make decisions better. And like what I said before, the circumstances and the environment that continues to feed into this notion that he is the best person for the job has, of course, affected him in his decisions, and which culminated in him proclaiming that he has the majority, which necessarily push him to an even more desperate position, because now he has to prove that he has a majority, which is sort of like a last-ditch attempt, because many people are counting on this opportunity to finally discount him from the equation, whereas his refusal against that can only be effective if he actually follows through with his strong, formidable and convincing majority claim. So I think he definitely understands that the struggle is important. I wouldn't discount that. But he also, to a certain extent, would think that he has the best leverage and talents to pull it off.
And who do you think should be the new leader of Pakatan Harapan? In a speech recently, as you brought up earlier, Shafiq Abdal talked about the need for a fresh leader to unite the opposition. And he implied that he should be the person. James, I think you might agree with me that Malaysia perhaps could use an East Malaysian Prime Minister, but is Shafiq Abdal that person?
Now, I am in a strange position recently because I am starting to speak to more people who are like twice or three times my age. And for the very first time, which is very unfamiliar to me, that they felt like old people like them should not be part of the picture anymore. So there is at least this sentiment among people who, let's say, who are above 50, who felt like politicians of their generation have done enough chaos, enough trouble to the system, that you owe it to the young people to let them try their hand at it. Now, I do believe that it is important that we have a clean slate, that the leader must necessarily be clean and could not have any baggages of the past. Now, I am not too acquainted with Shafiq Abdal, but I do understand to a certain extent that he has been part of the system before, and therefore he may carry certain baggages together with. What we do need is a fresh air who is able to have higher imaginations of what's possible, having courage to speak to the truth and willing to take risks of starting the whole thing over again rather than doing what's convenient. I understand that there are still very good-hearted, well-meaning politicians in the country who are clean, not involved in any corruption scandal, who are not people who has too much ties with the existing structure. So to a certain extent, that person has to be an outsider. But more importantly, this person cannot be tempted by power. What I mean by this is that to a certain extent, this person must have something to fall back on should his efforts of gaining or of leading the coalition fails. In other words, this person has to be relatively comfortable in losing because a lot of what opposition is wrong in the opposition coalition now is that it is very likely to fall back into this vicious cycle of pursuing power for pragmatic reasons. Right. And therefore, it is one important criteria for this new leader to have. I have seen leaders like that in the opposition, but of course, they were not given any opportunity. So a lot of the arguments have to end quite early on because our existing political system actually doesn't open up spaces for them. However, there's one caveat. Understanding that leaders with no baggage are important to have, I also think that to a certain extent, this leader must have some sort of experience working within the political system as well as outside the political system. So it must be that kind of criteria. And the reason for that is because I think the country would be better off with a person who have courage to follow through. And being maybe too young may not be suitable to qualify you as a leader. So you need to be of, let's say, having enough experience, like 10, 20 experience in the field to be able to deliver on the promises that will be tough. Because chances are, if you were to lead Pakatan Harapan or any opposition coalition, you probably have to start all over again.
So that was a clip from a show I did with political commenter James Chai on why Pakatan Harapan needs new leadership. And that's it for our Live and Learn 2020 recap on Malaysian politics. 2020 has been a complete mess for the most part as politicians on both sides of the aisle focused more on politicking and horse trading rather than issues concerning the people. So hopefully next year will be better in this regard. Anyway, if you'd like to listen to the full-length shows of the snippets I just featured throughout this show, all the links are in the description section of the show, which you can find on the BFM app or our website, bfm.my. You can also subscribe to BFM Live and Learn on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. Just search for BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.